Staging Sound, a podcast reflecting on theatre music, sound design, sonic practices and experiences. Okay, so welcome back officially to part two of our book launch episodes on our very freshly unboxed music and sound and European theatre book, which came out with Routledge in November last year, but really physically materialized in the last few days in our various inboxes. We had a very sprawling but good discussion in the first part about the first parts of the book. And before we launch, we sort of dive into parts 4, 5, and 6 for the remainder of this. Lynn wanted to raise a more general, wanted to kick us off with a more general question about the book. Lynn.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much indeed for this fabulous volume and collection. It's been a pleasure to read through these chapters. One of the themes, of course, of the book focuses on theatre music's important relationality. And this is an important methodology for making the case for theatre music's practice and it being a part of a process of theatre making, not just an object or an addition or something which makes other things apparent, that sound, particularly music, is in service to the dramatic or theatrical production. But what's interesting about the theme of relationality, and we've talked about it quite a lot in episode one of this podcast, is that actually each of the chapters also make a case for something more for theatre music in this relational, praxeological, to use Tamara's word, endeavour. And for example, David, you yourself talk about, and I'm just going to go to the little quote on page 19, that theatre music is music that listens. And when I was reading your chapter, I thought that the emphasis on relationality also hints a kind of suggested autonomy of theatre music, and that theatre music wants present as a part of any practice. Also has an exclusive, one might argue, or autonomous function within the work, whether that is to make audible sounds, and particularly voices that have been silenced or might remain unheard, or indeed to act as an invitation to marginalized cultures and identities, and becomes a conduit of transmission, if you like, into the theatrical event. So I just wanted to introduce this idea or to reflect really on your idea of an autonomous theatre music and to boldly ask, what can it do in and of itself? And to ask for reflections from this group. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. That's a very observant and good question. And I think maybe just to start with two remarks, I think what I'm trying to get across also in that chapter is that music is both less than and more than. Less than in the sense that it is usually music that leaves space. That's what I meant with music listens, in the sense that it leaves space for other events to co-inhabit that space, and it is very aware of it not being alone. Like, you know, concert music is usually alone in that space, and theatre music isn't. But the autonomy, or the question of the excess, the more than, is really about, it's not reducible to its functions. It's not fully described as, oh, this here creates an atmosphere, or this here highlights that this character is evil, or something like that, which are all, of course, functions that music can take on and does take on. But I would argue that theatre music often, maybe not always, but often has something more that we can't reduce to its function. And that can be evocative, it can be nostalgic, it can be sentimental, it can be annoying as well. You know, I've sat through performances where I was just not getting on board with the whole thing because I simply disliked the music a lot, you know, even though I could appreciate how it was done very well and had its function and had its, but it just didn't sit with me. And I felt, why is this making me so impatient with this theatre piece? And it was certainly not meant to do that. It was certainly not a function of that music. It can transcend, it can connect us to other spaces and places. I think the connotative quality of music, which I think no theatre director can ever fully strategize in the sense that, oh, I'll play this song and then everyone will think of this or that or the other. That never works quite that way. Yes, you can make very clear musical, you know, sort of semiotic hints at a time, a place, an event, an author, something. But very often it's something very personal, and all those things are sort of where the music always spills over, where it can't be contained, where it does things that we find difficult to capture, and that's kind of where I think it has an autonomy, or where it has also maybe sometimes an autonomous dramaturgy, in the sense that it follows its own logic that is not simply subservient to the dramaturgy of the piece, but has its own development. And many theatre musicians work in that way. When you talk to them, they don't really care whether the audience sort of is able to analyze this or unpick this, but they want a coherency, they want a sort of a musical logic in their piece that is just there for its own sake and not because it serves a purpose. So that was much more than two remarks that I intended, but any others from your own chapters or case studies? How would you describe what Lynn has asked after the kind of the autonomous nature of theatre music, the more than? Yeah, Peter.
I mean, I'm reminded of this almost enigmatic sentence that Jean-Luc Nancy writes about in the introduction to, what was it called, The History of Our Ears, the book. So he refers to the term ascoltando, as if there is a listening that can be composed inside the composition. Obviously, that should be the case with everything. Whenever you design sound in a specific way, there's always some thought of how it's being designed for listening, how the listener would relate to it. But there are moments when you are self-aware, when the listener becomes self-aware, and I think that is where the autonomy relies, you know, and specifically the case studies that we choose usually have had that moment in us that spoke to us in such a way that we wanted to explain it as researchers, as scholars in these different fields, to kind of re-embody or give a sense of that back to the reader of the book, this moment of how the listening is composed, is designed, is making you self-aware of your listening act. That doesn't mean that because a lot of the theater music is historically was much more of an effect, was always something in the background, or was something that, you know, I'm reminded of that other term that I recently learned, interpassivity, you know, the instead of interactivity, that kind of does the trick or the job for you. You don't need to do it yourself. It's just out there on the stage, and you can, you know, be the happy consumer of that. But even in those moments, in these interpassive relations that happen on the stage and with the auditorium, I think the sound is specifically designed to do that. So there can be still moments when you're pushed out of that and you see the whole mechanism, the strategies that are going on, also what Tamara was referring to with the scene, you know, the musical and the sonic means that produce the scene in terms of S-C-E-N-E, not the scene as S-E-E-N. So I think there's always a moment of autonomy when there's this moment of awareness of what the sound is doing to you. Is kind of demanding a kind of relation, you know, as also Lynn is saying, this relationality that is bestowed upon you as a listener, as a spectator.
Yes, I think Lynn's question is actually the absolutely perfect link through to Julia's chapter, because of course what she's talking about is the effects and impacts of sound and music on the audience. And it is therefore, by definition, the something more. So I thought that was actually a really perfect link.
Thank you so much, Millie, for doing my job of creating those bridges. That leads us neatly into part four of the book, which is called Theatre Music and or as Experience. Julia, you were just mentioned. Do you want to elaborate a bit on what your chapter investigates?
Thank you. Thank you for this bridge and introduction. In my chapter, I look at historical examples of psychoacoustics, which, yeah, there were sound designers, psychoacoustic researchers, and theater makers who were interested in the physical effect of sound, and they tried to use that in theater, and I'm really looking at some of those examples. So it's very historical, and it's not only happening in European theater, and it's about the introduction of electroacoustics in the theater and the possibilities of sound there. So I could play one of the examples, but maybe we are a bit late and we'll leave that out.
Thank you. That's great though, and we get a sense of what your chapter is about. The second chapter of this part four is by Millie. Millie, tell us a little bit about your chapter, please.
I'm talking specifically about the music and sound written for a production of The Tempest by William Shakespeare in 2016 at the RSC. And all the details about who did what are in the chapter. I think one of the things that we've discovered in this conversation is that many of the works that we focus on are unusual or exceptional, and that's why we're interested in them. And this work does fall into that category in the sense that it was the visual elements that were unusual and exceptional, and everybody was talking about them. And that was why I became interested in what was happening in the sound world and how that was making this piece exceptional, because everybody was completely ignoring it. And so I wanted to discover how the unheard, Claudia Gorman's term, reveals hierarchies. And so I was using musical genre to think about the human and non-human characters and the different classes, and the way that some widely used signifiers from film of magic and class are impacting on the politics of that production. And so I wanted to do a misquote from Hamilton. In Hamilton, it's talk less, smile more. And I think we should talk less, listen more, in terms of the music when we're at the theatre. But the second idea I was exploring was I was thinking about the ideas of structure that David was talking about in his chapter as well. You know, what are the sections that you might need to go through to think about this kind of work? And so I was splitting it into the context, which is really important, the diegesis and theatricality, which is something that's come up repeatedly, the idea of what's theatrical and what's heard and unheard. Atmosphere, which is predominantly the unheard material, and the concept.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a great read. I think you're pointing to a really interesting thing here with the question of, do we talk about theatre music best when we talk about the exceptions, the unusual cases, the, you know, and if we ignore the, I don't know, 90% of productions where it's used in quite conventional ways, and that may not be a negative thing. But anyway, yeah. Helena, you described an example which is also exceptional in many ways, which is the collaboration of Ulrich Rasche and Monika Roscher. Tell us a bit about your chapter in this context of music, theatre music as experience, because it's very experiential, no question about that.
Thank you, David. I will just start with a little glimpse into the chapter. My chapter at the interface of theater music and music theater is about the collaborations of the German director Ulrich Rasche and the German composer Monika Roscher, who has written the music for three of his stagings. Probably the most famous one is the Woyzeck production of 2017, which was produced at Theater Basel and was invited for the Theatertreffen in Berlin. It was very fascinating for me to observe the audience's reactions to the performances, as well as the attempts by the professional spectators to understand why they were so impressed by these performances. Often they attributed their immense also bodily reactions to what they saw on stage, like a rotating platform of impressive size, which forced the performance to constantly move forward. Interestingly, however, the music seems to have been one of the most essential parts of the performances, as it not only coordinated the movements and speech of the performers, but also had an immediate effect of the audience through the means of and the volume of its transmission. In this chapter, therefore, I analyze the different qualities of Rush's music for Rush's stagings and its perception by the critics. And I also deal with the question of genre, which the critics repeatedly raise. When the productions are described as spoken opera, music theater, or concert music, I believe this is an expression of the fact that the perception of the music's part in the performance experience goes beyond what critics would classify as theater music. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Yeah, that mirrors sort of some of the notions of theater music being sort of somewhat less than or not quite worthy or not quite worthy of discussion or analysis. And so we need to call it something else to make it worth commenting on, which is a bit ironic, isn't it? We have a fourth contribution to this chapter, which I'm going to share with you now, which is by Christiane Planck.
Hello to everyone. My name is Christiane Planck-Baldauf. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide a short summary of my contribution via audio. In my article about the relationship between storytelling and sound experience in theater for a young audience, I examine musical practices that alternate between acting and music theater. These productions were research-based and mostly created in collaborative working processes, often involving the young target group. Projects like Leise Laute of Schauburg München, Orlog of Theater Artemis, and Schrei des Pfauen in der Nacht of Deutsche Oper Berlin amplify the performativity of storytelling in order to include musical elements. Everyday sounds and noises became theatrical events, and the production of sounds turns into a scenic performance. The stories are usually not told in a continuously logical manner. Musical practices that are described in my article initiate a way of thinking in images and sounds, disrupting everyday contexts and enabling aesthetical experiences. At the same time, the nature of musical events opens spaces in which personal and social realities can be negotiated. The approach through music, sounds, and noises reduces entry barriers, both within creative processes and for the audience itself. The awareness of shaping the world and society can become a part of young people through the encounter and engagement with theater, its forms and aesthetics, its institutional production contexts, as well as with other cultures and languages.
Great. So that was Christiane describing her chapter in this part about the experiential nature, and I thought we were very glad to have her on board as well, because I think for most of our discussions we focused on theatre for grown-ups, as it were, sort of for adult audiences, and I think it would have been overlooking the huge role that music and sound strategies have in all kinds of theaters for children and young audiences to not include her. So I think she points to that very very well. Julia, you had a comment as well.
I was thinking of Emine's mentioning of the universalism And I was wondering how transferable it is to this chapter, especially with Helena's examples, which are, I guess, immediately pushing. So just great loudness in theater is just pushing you back on your seat. So it's a kind of universalism for human beings, isn't it? And I'm wondering how we deal with that. And I think the examples I had, they are limited in a way, because they are talking about concepts of, let's call it, manipulation, which are not necessarily did not necessarily work. But I think Helena analyzed some bits, and I wonder, Millie, if you also did that. And the question is, of course, in the children's chapter, is that for young audiences in general, or is it for specific social groups? So this whole discussion, it could be interesting to try to widen it into this chapter. I wonder, I mean, do you still have time to comment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I wonder, it makes me think, as I was listening to your comments, so I guess there are kind of various levels at which claims to universality can be made, right? So there's the kind of universality that is that becomes part of the discourse of the work itself, that is like that kind of patterns the intentions of the artist. And I guess then we have to kind of think about like the way in which they're contextualizing the music to think about whether it's claiming a kind of universalizing function. And then there's of course the question of universality at the level of reception, not intention, and that is a whole can of worms. And I think many of you thinking about music and how music communicates are much better versed to be able to kind of think about that. I guess then there's a kind of further diversification in the sense that what kind of methodological tradition are you coming from in as you approach the question of reception? Is it coming from a more kind of phenomenologically influenced direction, or are we kind of are we kind of staying with the notion that, you know, music, even at its most kind of like expansive and bodily, is still fundamentally discursive in nature, right? So I guess which of those traditions you subscribe to, I guess, will also kind of impact how you think about how universality communicates to its audience. But I think, again, these are fascinating questions.
It's a really interesting conversation. But I think particularly because what Julia has done in the chapter is to explore the psychology of impact, of effect, which is a very different thing than the contextual or generic or the interpretation in reception terms. And I think that's really interesting. And nothing to do with my chapter at all. Everybody talks these days about the way mega musicals are immersive. And of course, what they're doing is simply surrounding you with sound in exactly the way Julia is talking about. So, you know, that was the connection I was making, was that whole sort of scientific, that psychological phenomenon was quite interesting in the way we're thinking about what music can add.
It's part of that Jonathan Stern's litany of the audiovisual, you know, where he talks about the visual being sort of in front of you and sound being around you, sound being a 360-degree experience, which, of course, on the face of it, is true, but anyway, but it's certainly true that if we look at how cinemas are laid out now, how the theaters tend to use Dolby 5.1 or even Dolby 7.1 as you know, as a standard technology of playing back sound, it clearly there is an argument to be made that they want to at least physically immerse audiences, you know. And yet again, I'm always in a genre, when you talk about the mega musical, in which people express their feelings by singing and stare at the audience and dance, you know, to say it is immersive to the point that we forget that we're watching a performance is, I find, always a bit ridiculous, you know. But I get the point of it being immersive in the sense that you're swept up in it and you're not necessarily engaging critically with it necessarily, which I don't think the musical prohibits you from doing. I think there's many good examples where it actively encourages you for a critical and engaged sort of and certainly not, what is the word, interpassive way of watching them. That is a completely sweeping argument against the musical, which I don't subscribe to. But yeah.
But I think the chapters do bring out that difference between, you know, the moments when you push back into your seat, the moments when you're immersed,
yeah,
which I would probably equate more with mega musical style performances and productions and sound design, in comparison with the record player being on the stage, the Foley, and so on, which is designed to disrupt in the same way that you could argue that the concert musical does. You know, that the theatricality of certain types of performances deliberately do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, you know, the fact that music works not only on a cognitive or interpretative level where we go, oh, this seems to mean that or that, but it is physical, it is vibration, it may even have, you may feel nausea because of the subwoofer, you know, being very loud or whatever it might be. So it is, there is an element to it which is very embodied and very sort of somatic, really, rather than cognitive, I think. Yeah. Sorry, Helena, you wanted to.
I was just thinking of the trigger warnings. When there is a lot of light coming into, some people are warned before the performance. And in the Russia productions, somehow there was an implicit warning when the earplugs were delivered to the audience. But somehow, I think maybe this was also a bit the issue with you, David. People felt sometimes cheated because they knew it was something to do with the sound, that they were so impressed and pushed back, and but somehow, like Julia also said, manipulated, because they thought it were the musicians on stage who did the sound. That's what they write about. But in the end, they put the loudspeakers under the seats, so you couldn't get away from the sound even with the earplugs. And so I was wondering if one really should also inform the audience about the strategies that are applied by using the theater music in this way. And maybe, and the second question was, who is the audience? Is the theater going audience another one, like the musical and cinema going audience? Well, I think so, because they don't even get earplugs, and maybe they expect this experience more than theater goers. Yeah, that were my thoughts.
Thank you, Peter.
That completely challenges the whole universality question, because obviously, you know, the universality is there because all the audience members are human. I mean, put a cat in the audience, the cat will respond in a different way. I mean, we all have a basic set of cognitive tools to, you know, at our disposal, but obviously there are people who are more sensitive. And so I was also just thinking about people with misophonia or phonophobia. There are no trigger warnings for them, obviously, because maybe the artist wants to, you know, put them on the edge. But yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as a real universality in how people react. And there are people who are more willing to go along with the immersion, also in a mega musical, for instance, than others. Maybe people just don't go to the performance knowing that they will be immersed. But if not, yeah, then yeah, you have different reactions. And that is, of course, the biggest question for the again, the sound designer, for the you know, people behind the music production as well. How do we have the majority of the audience reacting the way we want them to react?
Well, I was going to say that what's interesting, I think, about sound design as well is that often it's not intended to be realistic. If you're going to do a gunshot in a theatre, you don't do a real gunshot. You make a sound that will make the audience think it's a gunshot, but not necessarily scare them. It'll make them jump the amount you want them to jump. And so I guess I'm moving away from the idea of, you know, what is universal or not, but it was that idea of scaring that made me think that actually sound design, and actually something I mentioned in my chapter, is there was a way of making supposedly natural sounds that were also heightened so that they sounded slightly artificial, because that fed into the way of the story. And so I think aspects of sound design are actually much more complicated, even when they're being immersive, because of the unheard nature. So you have this idea that, you know, you're sitting in this beautiful glade and you've got the birds singing and so on, but it's just a bit more. And that has a different effect than a very quiet background noise that you barely hear and don't actually notice. And so I think there is something that is, I'm avoiding universal, but the idea that atmospheric sounds have an impact on all of us who share similar auditory tools.
And it also raises, before I move us on to part five, it raises really an ethical dimension of music and sound in theater. You know, to what degree, I think a few of you have mentioned the word to manipulate, you know, and that can be seen perhaps as a positive thing in facilitating a particular experience, which we may find, you know, emotional or overwhelming or immersive or whatever the word is. But it you know, as we all know also from history and from stagings of particular political events that use music in a particularly, you know, whipping up a crowd and or creating the false sense of patriotism or whatever it might be that we can do with music, and theater is also a place that needs to address and discuss and test out those ethical dimensions of music and sound as well, which is something that comes out great. Thank you so much for your thoughts on part four. Part five is called Theatre Music Between and Beyond Genres. And I think the notion that we also touched on in the introduction of the book, with which we tried to encapsulate what the many dimensions the book has, was to also say it's very difficult to clearly pinpoint where theatre music is happening. Is it only in what in Germany we call Sprechtheater, which is a terrible word, you know, spoken theatre or speaking theatre? And what do we learn from looking at other disciplines or genres or constellations or frames, however we want to call them? And we had three chapters here, which sort of branch off slightly. The first, which is by Christina Fischer, branches off into opera properly, and it's called Performance Worlds, Reflections on Music Theater Scenes, formerly called Diegetic. And I think one of the core questions she really asks is if that notion of the diegetic and the non-diegetic, which we have in film very much, but which has been applied to theater music in its various instantiations as well, whether that actually holds up, whether that's actually a notion, whether that dichotomy is really tenable, and whether we should sort of perhaps revisit this dichotomy. And she then applies some of the questions to sort of diegetic music, or what was formerly, as she called it, formerly called diegetic music, in particular historical opera settings. For example, Agostino Stefani's opera Niobe Regina di Tebe from 1688. So, you know, we're going way back in history. That's really a chapter that kind of casts light on the questions that theatre music raises, but by looking at opera and opera studies and coming from that discipline. The second chapter in this part, which again looked at the role of music more from maybe what you could call performance/installation, was written by Maria Capsali, who talks about a production of Inside Yellow Sound and the vibration of the audience's soul. And she sent us a clip, which I'll let her introduce the piece herself.
This would also be a good moment to add that all the sounds played in between sections of the podcast were part of the performance Inside Yellow Sound, which Maria Capsali co-created and has written about in her chapter. And the sound compositions are by Nikos Stravopoulos and the technology design by Kingsley Ash.
Inside Yellow Sound and the Vibrations of the Audience's Soul discusses an interactive installation which realized Vasily Kandinsky's stage composition Yellow Sound, written in 1911. The chapter presents the importance of sound in Kandinsky's work and draws links with recent performance theory on affect. It argues that music not only was an important aspect of the composition, but that the text features a musicality dispositif. Music as pure art and sound as cosmic vibration become the model through which the ideas of the text are organized and would be eventually communicated. Yellow sound is supposed to bypass a form of meaning-making based on representation and instead affect audiences pre-reflectively and non-discursively, deeply and fully. Kandinsky's unique vision of the theatrical event raises questions about the staging of the text today. Could the use of interactive technologies make possible the kind of feedback loop between artistic content and audience reception Kandinsky strove for? And can these technologies pave the way for new forms of practice of theatre music? In light of these questions, the chapter closely examines the way the dramaturgy of the Kandinsky's text was mapped onto the rules of the interaction of the installation. Through the participants' movement, an environment of sound and light activates the pictures of Kandinsky's composition, and the action that Kandinsky envisaged across the scenic elements becomes relocated in the participants' movement and motion trajectory. The spectator of theatre music gets up from her seat and begins to dance.
Very nice. And the third chapter, which we already had some previews in within this discussion from Peter, is from Peter. And tell us about your piece, which is really to do with dance and dance theatre as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I squeezed in a little bit of a summary already in the first episode. I mean, this chapter could have been also in the experience part, since I'm actually talking about how, I mean, we were discussing it just now as well, the somatic and the cognitive kind of come together. And so how we experience music on stage in an embodied way, but we also cognitivize, we also interpret it in a specific way, and how these two can be bridged, can be thought together. And that's something that I do through the concept that Glitzos provides me of the body-mind as one word. So there's no split in between or hyphen or whatever. The body-mind as a holistic thing, which is, of course, the spectator, but actually everybody who is involved in the staging. And when I wrote this chapter, I really had also my own students in mind from the BA and the MA programs in my university, the University of Groningen, where we teach about, you know, how can we analyze our experiences. So this is, of course, it's about one specific dance music or dance theater piece called Singulier Odyssee by the Dutch Dance Theater. And many of the things that I speak of are actually can be extended to any performance that has music in it, or theater music for that matter, when it is used in a more atmospheric or ambient kind of way. I kind of start from that one idea that comes from Böhme, the idea that atmospheres on the stage, they give us a sense of another reality, they kind of brings us in touch of a kind of ecstasy of things, and that kind of, you know, needs to then, we need to kind of relate to, we need to do something with that. The way that I try to explain it is through the cognitive narratology. And I know that this is one specific way of looking. Again, it's not for every viewer the same, for every spectator the same. But when music is being staged in relation to visual cues, gestures, scenography, there is a tendency to create a narrative within you, to narrativize. It's an impulse, you know, that you can relate to the music and to the staging in such a way. And then I kind of bring in two specific concepts to explain what is happening, you know, when you start to create that kind of narrative. On the one hand, there is the experientiality in the listening. That means you relate kind of even these abstract things as sonic, you know, vibrations to things that you know in your own history, in your own way of thinking. So that's kind of what Mielberg calls also a sonic thinking, a thinking through sounds. And the other concept is the inaction of empathic simulation, which is this concept that has been, you know, already around for 20 years now, ever since we discovered these mirrored neurons in macaque apes. That also explains, you know, how we kind of simulate behaviors, how we put emotional responses to things that we can relate to, because it relates also to our own body, to things that we have experienced before. I try to kind of answer a question on authorship, on authorism. What happens if different authors of a piece, in this case the dance theater, say different things about the making process. So that we have, on the one hand, we have the composer Max Richter, who composed Exiles, and he says, look, I've been inspired by, you know, mass migration on the images that we see on the telly, and I want people to respond to that through this minimalist music, which, you know, and there's a whole history of minimalist music on the stage that kind of puts you into this pensive mood, and but also melancholic moods, which then can be relatable in terms of, you know, people moving around and having to lose their home country. Whereas the choreographers of the piece say, look, you know, we don't want to be didactic, we don't want to make it political, we make it a subjective story of ourselves. In this case, Soliol and Paul Lightfoot, who were a couple before, but they parted ways, and they kind of bring their own stories into the gestures of the dancers on the stage, which is a very personal story. In the end, all of these paradoxical experiences and ideas, if you have the author's voices in your mind from these interviews, can actually be an incitement or an invitation, I think, for you to make your own story out of that. So I think the discrepancies, the slippages between these authorial voices is actually interesting for the spectator who is then trying to make a whole of it. The last question I try to answer is the ethical question. David, you are also referring to that. What does that mean that a composer who is not a refugee or a migrant himself, who is a white, you know, very privileged composer who is composing from his own backyard, you know, looking at these, you know, migrants passing through. What does that mean ethically? You know, can that person, that composer, actually do that? And I think the ethical question has been already dealt with in post-traumatic theater with concepts like responsibility, yes, through the aesthetics and the politics of listening that happens on the stage. I think it is ethical that we kind of try to embody these stories in our own ways and then bringing that what is distant closer to us. And so that is also what is expressed through this new term of agonistic solidarity, that there is a solidarity from far away, but at the same time, it touches us deeply inside. And I think especially through this inaction of empathic simulation, that can happen. And that's what music can do even more than gestures or choreographies on the stage.
Great, fantastic. Thank you for that. I think, I mean, just to start us off, I think what's very evident, and you've mentioned it yourself, Peter, is that looking from a slightly adjacent field, you know, back towards practices of music and theatre music can be very enlightening. That was one of the reasons why we felt it would be good to include those chapters, even though on the surface they deal with installation, opera, dance, you know, but in at their core they tell us a lot about fundamental questions that you've outlined very well for your own chapter are there that have to do with this particular connection of the scenic and the musical. You know, even those terms are problematic. You've mentioned, Peter, that you talk about authorship, and that's a very interesting question that, you know, we touch on here and now in the book, that, you know, who's the author of theatre music, particularly in practices where it's not a single person's job, particularly in the Anglophone or at least British context, for example, where there's very often a composer and a sound designer responsible. And to the point, and very keen listeners of this podcast will have heard Paul Clark describe his relationship to sound designers such as Melanie Wilson in his work, where they pass back and forth sound files to the point that they don't know who did what on that track, you know, and who composed which part and who has, you know, redesigned it or et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so that's another thing. And the other term that all three chapters are very much so, Maria's and Christina's chapters also reflect on, is spectatorship. So if we talk about authorship, then spectatorship, and of course your chapter as well, Peter, talks about how does the spectator complement and add and shape and determine, you know, how to perceive, how to receive what they hear and what sense it makes and what connections a Sting song or whatever it might be will conjure up.
Yeah, just to give it small, I mean, I don't know exactly, you know, the real answer to that, but, you know, since Roland Barthes' idea, or the death of the author is the birth of the reader, I think the author has been, you know, creeping up on us from very different ways all the time. You know, it's not true. I mean, yes, even the reader has an authorial concept in their minds, and maybe it's not one voice, maybe it's different voices that we kind of blend together. But we do need still that sense of someone is talking to us, is telling us a story, is giving us some kind of guidance in how to deal with that, even if it's a reflection of my own superego, maybe. I mean, we can't do away with the author. And maybe that's also good in a way that sound designers and composers who feel forgotten, might be for them that, you know, also good to know that actually they are not forgotten. We do listen, we do hear them.
Great. Thank you. So let's move on then to part six as a final thought, which is not an afterthought, but it is a change in direction in the sense that from spectatorship and authorship, we come to the parts that determine theatre music before it actually sees any production, which is the training and the notions of how do we train, how do we educate artists to create theatre music. And we have two interesting texts here. And the first is by Elia Moretti, and I'm going to play his introduction to the chapter for you all now.
Hello, everyone. I'm really grateful to have contributed to this work alongside such inspiring minds. Thank you so much. I am Elia Moretti, and I have contributed with the chapter An Ethnographic Account of Learning and Training Theatre Music in the Czech and Slovak Independent Theatre Scene. For this chapter, I've started by reflecting on how the way we train and study music is already part of the creative processes we will engage in later in life. It's as if by training in a certain way, we define a strategy of composition. In my view, all knowledge, perception, and thought arise from the interactions between an organism and its environment, a dynamic environment that includes objects, norms, habits, institutions, and tools that shape the way we think and create. As I've been in Prague for some time now, I've been curious about the journeys of musicians and composers currently doing theatre music in the Czech Republic and Slovakia. It was fascinating to meet and listen to their paths and experiences. My chapter reflects on the skills and motivations that enable musicians to become active, critical participants in the theatre landscape. An interdisciplinary and collaborative training theatre music could not only increase the recognition of the role of theatre musicians, but also foster more meaningful creative dialogues between theatre makers and musicians. However, this research suggests that rather than standardizing curricula, it's vital to support the agency of learners, enabling them to chart their own unique journeys in the field. Thank you once again. Ciao.
Ciao. Thank you, Elia, for your contribution. And the final text is a slight exception to the rule that, of course, all the chapters in the book were original contributions for this particular book. And this last chapter by Katharina Ross, it had been published in a journal some years ago, but I found that it really added an aspect that we hadn't touched upon throughout the book and that was important, which was similar but different to what Elia has just described, sort of a look at institutions of learning theatre music. She did like a discourse analysis of books, handbooks that try to educate theatre makers in how to produce good sound. And that was the focus of her analysis of a number of influential sources, which are still around, which are still used in curricula across particularly the UK. She identified a number of key principles, such as adequacy, inconspicuousness, and prioritization as sort of key markers of good sound design, of what people describe as good sound design, in the sense that the adequacy, the sound, you know, must align with the play's setting and narrative. Inconspicuousness, in the sense that sound design should avoid drawing attention to itself. maintaining the illusion of the performance. And we've heard a lot in this discussion when it does not do that and deliberately does not do that. And prioritization, and this is again the old question about, you know, is theatre music mainly there to serve, to function in a particular way? So music should never take precedence. It should always be second to spoken words and dramatic action. So all these are historic kind of notions of what theatre music and theatre sound should do. And then in the final part of her article, she talks about precisely about trends in contemporary theatre, post-dramatic theatre, etc., that break with these traditions, that try to go new ways and really develop into an art form with its own aesthetic and in its own right, which we've discussed a lot. But to have this sort of historic backdrop, you know, to have that notion of where historically things have been seen is very valuable. And I think those two chapters really complement the book in the sense that they draw attention to discourses and notions and institutions and questions of agency that Aaliyah has just mentioned about what theatre music training can encompass. Tamara, do you have any additional thoughts on that? Did you want to add something to that?
I think these two articles really sum up what we were talking about. For example, we talked about the many new terms that we try to find to describe what theatre music is. And I think that is also something that you see in education and also in these handbooks, that these paths had to be gone, but maybe by every artist in a different and in an individual way. And that is why for everybody, maybe these are some other terms and some other ways to go, because theatre music is maybe really a practice and not so much a genre or something that we know what it is, but it is every time something different. And I think that is exactly what Aaliyah describes in his article when he did all these interviews with young theatre musicians.
Yeah, and I think he touches also on a question that I think has been also around in our project on German theatre musicians, the tension between the freedom on the one hand, that there's no in the German language sort of area, there's no university course or training or, you know, a conservatoire training that you can actually take to become a theater musician. You have to sort of find your own path. So that is at the same time a liberty and something very liberating and gives you agency and responsibility in creating and forging that path yourself. And at the same time, it means that some of the key techniques or insights are not being taught. You know, they're not being sort of enshrined in some kind of curriculum, and it means that it also means sometimes that people are not recognized as much because they can't say, well, I've trained at RADA or I've trained at the Folkwang University or somewhere where people go, oh, okay, so that's that school and that's that particular legacy or that particular lineage, you know, that we can attribute you to. And so there's a tension in that which this book does not dissolve, and those two articles don't dissolve, but they point very, very well at those kind of inner tensions about how do you pretend that there's a good way of learning theatre music? How do you discuss the commodification of craft in that particular way? Great. I think we'll probably leave it at that for part six. And I just wanted to mention at the very end, but certainly again not last, that this book also has a wonderful foreword, which is by the esteemed scholar and practitioner Ross Brown. So we did mention it at the beginning where it should have perhaps belonged, but it's a really great way. In a few pages, he really pinpoints, you know, some of the incredible fascinations about that conjunction of theatre and music, and it is such a great sort of way to open the curtain of that book that I just wanted to mention and really express my gratitude also to Ross to having written that and really finding an ideal introduction into the topic for us and opening up a number of really interesting questions. Did you have anything to add to that, Tamara? Or
during our conversation for the podcast today, I really have understood that this book, Music and Sound in European Theatre, is really about the possibilities to talk about theater music, about possibilities, how theater music and theater musicking as a vital practice can be done and performed, how it can be described and analyzed, how it can be perceived, and how it can be understood or even not understood. I think this book is absolutely not about a definition of music and sound in European theater, since of course this book does not claim to be complete. But it is really about different practices, about different performances, and most of all, about different perspectives. I think that term theater music as a shape shifter is very important to sum up that book. This is one of the main reasons why it is valid to have a special look at the practices of doing theater music. This means to move the focus from an analysis of the outcomes to the processes of inventing and creating theater music. And these processes are multiple, various, and as unique as theater musicians and the theater musicking people and surroundings are.
Great. I think this is us done because it's been two long episodes. But I think what this discussion has demonstrated how engaging and complex a seemingly marginal topic like theater music can be, and how it actually touches on very central and very important issues around contemporary theater and theater making and ethics of representation and all those kind of things. We really hope you've enjoyed it. We even more hope that you will be able to pick up a copy of our book somewhere. It's unfortunately, like most academic publications, not a cheap buy at this point. I'm sure it'll come out as a paperback at some point. At this moment, it's probably best to find it in a library near you. But I hope you do so or recommend it to your students or colleagues or practitioners. And if you want to, please let us know what you think about it. You can find us all on our various websites, and I'll put down the names of all participants in the show notes as well. For now, thank you so much for everyone who joined in the discussion today. Thank you, Tamara, so much for co-editing this book with me, for going this long journey together, which I think we've navigated well, and I'm very proud and a little bit relieved as well, I think, to see this book finished and out in the world and hopefully finding traction and finding some readers. Thank you so much, and until the next episode.